Alrighty, folks, I call this meeting of the Fluvana County Board of Supervisors to order. We will begin with the moment of with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by the moment of silence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. I got you.
Thank you.
Tony?
Alrighty, folks, I apologize for running behind. Do we have an adoption of the agenda? Are there any changes? Glory be. No changes to the agenda? Are you sure? Alright, do we have a motion for the adoption of the agenda?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Got a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Booker. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Mr. Dahl.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the board have a few things to report this evening. So, happy early birthday is in order for Mr. Fairchild coming up here.
I didn't know.
Just wanted to remind you, just in case. Also, we've got just some staff updates. We got a new building services worker. One, Betty Patterson came here, is working in the facilities department. She started with the county on May 23rd. Happy to have her with the county with her experience in other areas. She came from the women's correctional facility, so we're happy to have her working here for the county. Also, the carnival, the May carnival that was held from May 11th to the 14th, unfortunately they encountered some rain on the evening of the Friday, the May 13th on Friday, and then a good portion of the morning on May 14th on Saturday, so that limited their hours a little bit. Well, they're only open on Saturday from 1 p.m. to 7:30. This screen here just kind of shows just kind of a breakdown of kind of how some of the revenues and expenses are. So these are the red are really expenses that the county incurred for putting on the carnival, and down below here is a breakdown of the revenue broken up between the carnival vendor and the county. So the long and short of it is expenses were $4,800 to the county, and revenues for the county were $5,700. So it was about a net wash, but a good time for a lot of kids that were going around the Ferris wheel and all those other rides until they got sick. So, but again, like I said, you know, whenever we don't have rain, it's always a really popular event, and like I said, you know, happy to have them back and do it again. For Parks and Rec, they're doing adult kayaking on Lake Monticello. So the program was held on May 20th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., kind of a sunset paddle a little bit. They had 12 participants with a wait list of 5. Age range was 54 to 70 years of age. They started at Beach 4, paddled to Beach 3 and back. There's an upcoming adult kayak float on the Rivanna River Saturday, June 11th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Cost is $25, and they just need to pre-register in advance. They currently have 6 spots available. And we've got a couple ribbon cuttings for businesses coming up this Saturday, June 4th. So we have a new business, Bump to Baby, that they're opening up Mishmack right up there on 250, right in the... Do you remember what the complex is called?
Yeah, where Mike Arnold is.
It's kind of the business park that almost looks like townhomes almost.
The Zion Station, is that what that's called?
It's not Zion Station.
It used to be the modular home.
Yes.
Models,
yeah. The model home, the old model home place. So that's where the business is. So it's going to be 10 a.m. this Saturday at 5570 Richmond Road. Also on Saturday, June 4th at 1 p.m., Fluvana County Firearms is the business that opened up down in the Fort Union District, right there on Route 6. They're at 6672 James Madison Highway. So a couple ribbon cuttings for both of those businesses on Saturday. And just some upcoming meetings. June 15th, we have a regular...
I won't be here that day.
June 15th, okay. June 15th, we have a 7 p.m. regular meeting, which will be here at the library. We only have one meeting for July, which will be July 6th, so we'll have a 5 p.m. regular meeting and then a 7 p.m. Meeting as well, which we will be able to hold any public hearings or anything at that time. And that, again, that July 6th meeting will be here in the library. And then back on August 3rd, we'll have a 5 p.m. regular meeting. We'll be back to the Performing Arts Center at that point. Happy to answer any questions at the board house.
Any questions? Thank you very much. And I apologize for interrupting you, but I just wanted to make sure y'all knew that that was the meeting I was going. All righty, now we'll open up the first round of public comment. Anyone wish to address the board, please step to the podium. State your name and address. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is there anyone wish to speak at this time? Is there anybody online? Okay, I will now close the first round of public comments. There are no public hearings. We will now move forward with the action matter. Blue Banner County Arts Council Memorandum of Understanding, Ms. Harris.
Good evening. Here I am again.
Why don't you not bring up that other topic right now?
Yeah, I know. And this one's good for 10 years also, so somebody else can deal with it in 10 years. So tonight I am happy to finally get this in front of you, Memorandum of Agreement between County of Fluvanna and Fluvanna County Arts Council. I think we've talked about this quite a lot. I'm not sure we need to go through with fine-tooth comb, but let me hit the highlights. There has been an agreement in place with the Arts Council at least since 1996, probably prior to that, but at least there's a written signed agreement. Again, updated in 1999, and in 2008, the board passed a resolution on the use of Carysbrook at that time. And then in March, a month later, they actually adopted a policy for use, a resolution and policy. And then a little bit deeper, agreement where the Arts Council provided an inventory, so it was a very clear separation of who owned what and had added to the beauty of the place. In 18, there was a policy format, but no substantive changes to the policy. So there had been quite a while since there had been any changes to the agreement that was in place on how to use or who was responsible for what for this policy. So today I am bringing before you the draft memorandum of agreement for your consideration, and I really don't want to look at it again for a very long time. Just as a reminder for anybody who might have known, that says 94, so see that? I can't even get my dates right. So 94, 96 is when that agreement was in place, last updated in 2008. The Arts Council came to the county at least a year ago, probably more like two, but COVID has robbed me of knowing what years are which. Wanting to assume more control over the scheduling of the space, as well as expanding their offerings of art, and then COVID. April of 2020, the circuit court closed to any non-judicial happenings, so we lost our place for the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission to meet. We moved over to the Morris Room until COVID restrictions on the number of people who could meet in the space forced us out of the Morris Room, and we moved here from May of 2020 until September of 2021. In September, the library very much needed to have their book sale again. They've not been able to have it through COVID. It is a big revenue maker for the library, so we really wanted them to be able to have that. So we moved again in October of 2021. At the same time, there were Planning Commission public hearings and board public hearings that had generated a lot of public interest, and this was not a large enough space anyway. So we moved again, and this time we moved over to the Performing Arts Center. The Arts Council had canceled all of their in-person offerings because of COVID, and so it seemed like a good fit at the time. It quickly became apparent that we're going to have to figure out a way to share that space, and so here we have done the wrangling and the wrestling, and I bring to you today two problems to be solved. Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission needed a long-term meeting space, and Fluvanna County Arts Council needed an available space to offer their for their offerings to the community. This proposed MOA offers a compromise agreement to share the space and a management for the space for the community art offerings. So this is the last slide. What I wanted to show was there was some discussion about the budget season. We sort of, that part got missed a little bit when we were putting this together. And there was some concern that we were, after we had wrangled and wrestled and come up to a compromise, that all of a sudden there was this new stumbling block. So this demonstrates the availability during budget season, so from February through the end of April. And it really only impacted one additional week. Otherwise, it's our regular schedule, so that's the most that the Performing Arts Center would not be available. And then June and July, it will be completely available to the Arts Council. I am mostly happy to answer any questions you may have.
And Sharon Harris.
And Ms. Harris is on as well.
Is on too. And if you want Ms. Harris to provide any comments.
Anyone?
You say this is a draft, but it's not an action.
Well, it's draft only because you haven't acted on it yet. It is ready for you to act on it.
Okay. I wish I had, this is my fault, I wish I had seen the first, what did you do? The last one that you had, 208. Because it said it wanted more control, and I was trying to figure out what was it that they couldn't do in the 208 one.
If there were any outside organization, and so maybe it's a misnomer to say that. So all activities went through the Director of Parks and Recreation to schedule the space.
Okay.
The Arts Council wanted to be able to schedule the acts themselves rather than having to go through. So that happened. We don't really anticipate there will be outside organizations who are using the space, and that is contemplated in this agreement with insurances and all of that. So that piece of it has been included now. So they will be the booking agent for that space.
Okay. And the other question I had was why did we have to go and have a lawyer draw up this agreement? Why couldn't the administration and the council, why couldn't they come up with that?
All of our agreements.
It's got to be
all of our agreements go through the attorney.
So we went from a memorandum of understanding to a law agreement, because in 2008 that was a law agreement.
I assume so. Without looking at it right now, I can't tell you that for certain, but it is standard practice now that all of our MOAs, MOUs, anything contractual goes through the county attorney's office.
Okay. So the one with the AARC that went through the lawyer?
The AARC building?
Are we there last week?
Yes, I'm sure.
The one where we did the money to do the work. Absolutely.
When we did the memorandum of understanding for that, that I'm certain that went through the county attorney's office back at that point.
I just had some problems with, excuse my voice, I had some problems with the 10 years. I had some problems with parking, where to park, and that it couldn't park. Really, regulation, it sounded as if the ARC was a business, was another company coming from somewhere else. It just didn't sound like it was us working with our citizens.
You mean the Arts Council?
Arts Council, with the Arts Council. It just was so formal and so,
I guess the flip.
It lost some love. For me,
we worked a lot with Miss Sharon Harris, I think it just really clarifies who's responsible for what. And again, it was not meant to be an us against them that you can't do this. But again, it certainly clarifies that we have a need for space at certain times, and really mostly it's available. It's available to them, with the exception of some of those, Wednesday and Thursdays.
So for 30 days a year.
Yeah. So, I understand what you're saying, Ms. Booker, but again, any type of agreement, memorandums of understanding, memorandums of agreement, those do go through the county attorney's office. There are generally requirements from, you know, insurance requirements, other legal language that just needs to be in there to protect the county. And it's not that we think that the Arts Council is going to do anything against that, but again, it's a county building, and we just need to make sure we're looking after the county's interests first.
You know the old expression, good fences make good neighbors.
Okay.
And it is to protect both sides, so there's no ambiguity about what it's agreed to.
Yeah, I saw a paragraph in there was very clear on what would happen if the Art Council did not follow certain regulations. I didn't see any stipulations for the county, and maybe I missed them. You all know how I feel about that building, and you know how I feel about the fact that we've got a community center for community that's just sitting there. And you know, every time we sit here and talk, I say, why can't we update that Florida County Community Center for Union and move there and not disrupt the Art Council? Many, many things for the community happens there. And I'm just laying it out on the table. I mean, that's the way I feel. And it's going to move forward, it's going to move forward. The way it read, the Art Council is in agreement with it. I assume they will sign it. And at that point, then my request has no value unless this board decides that we're going to make Alpharetta County Community Center something that we can be proud of. I told y'all last month that I was finished fussing about coming on to talk to you in the community center. But I'm still not finished. I'm finished right now. But I'm still, I think I may get some decorations, whatever, drawing to show what we can do down there to make that place, let people come over and do things on the southern side of the county. Since we have a business park, we're moving on up. And it's been sitting here like that ever since Fauquier School closed in 1998 or something like that. So, okay, thank you.
With regard to the 10-year terms, the term is a one-year term with 10 automatic renewals. At the end of that 10 years, it does not mean we'll not enter into another agreement. It just automatically triggers a review to make sure it's working, if we haven't done it in the 10 years during it. At any point, either side can request a review. So we get to next year, and it's just not working. We review it at that point. Or we get 5 years down the line, and it's been working, but all of a sudden something happens. So there's nothing in this agreement that prohibits either side from bringing it back up for review at any point during the renewal periods, but if it's all hunky-dory, it just renews automatically for 10 years, at which point we'll look at each other again across the table and say, how do we make it better?
So the only way it would change is to be better in the administration.
Or unless we fix up another space or we're moving around, yeah.
I had some questions in the agreement too. However, they weren't questions. I don't want to get in the way of anything. And I talked a few weeks ago with Ms. Harris and to give me a lot of time to understand their wants and concerns. And it was clear to me that this agreement, as it sits, is one that they were ready to sign, and they're happy to have an agreement. And I'd say, my thought was always, and I mean this at least genuinely from my side, so let's have more of that conversation. While I don't want to scuttle the ship for the Arts Council when they're right at the moment of being able to get an agreement in place and start being able to use the facility again.
Anyone else? All righty. Let's see. So we have, we're looking for head nods here, right?
No, this is actual...
Action matter.
Actual vote.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, note that this is memorandum of agreement about sharing space.
Right.
It does not require a public hearing for exhibit release.
Correct. All righty. If there are no other questions or discussion from the board, do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the memorandum of agreement between the County of Humana and the Arts Council for space sharing and management of the Garrettsburg Performing Arts Center and authorize the County Administrator to execute the agreement subject to approval as to form as formed by the County Attorney.
Do I have a second?
Oh, my second. I was thinking about the agreement.
I didn't think we were going to second it. Motion been made by Ms. Seeger, seconded by Mr. Fairchild. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-1.
Ms. Harris is on Zoom. I don't know if she had anything.
Did you want to add anything, Ms. Harris? No.
Just thank you, and we'll get you guys invited to all of the things that we have planned. We're trying to get a calendar up and running, and we appreciate you guys hanging in there with us to try to work this out. I hopefully it will be something that will benefit the community. And Ms. Booker, we want to try to help make something happen in Fort Keenan as well. We have some tech folks who are really great experts, so call on us when you guys get to that point.
Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Booker, I'm going to second what Mr. Fairchild was talking about. With the formation of the business park over there and everything, and correct me if I'm wrong, about this stuff with the schools, I think last month was the first time I remember you bringing it up vehemently. That's the first time I remember it. And that would provide us a meeting place. They're probably going to have meeting places in their own buildings, but they may want to have something to do there. So that, to me, would be a CIP project for next year possibly to look into. Alrighty, next up are appointments. Board commissions and committee appointments. And that is Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the board. So again, just like we did at the last meeting, and again, we kind of spread this out. Instead of having all the board appointments on one evening, which would have been a lot, we just kind of spread it out over three meetings. So again, we invited whether they're on Zoom or in person to kind of speak to the board and just kind of let the board know a little bit about them and why they're interested in serving on whatever board and committee that they're on. So again, we've got one vendor rep for CPMT. We have for the EDA, we have three at-large appointments. And then for Piedmont Virginia Community College, we have one citizen representative. I think like we did last time, if you want to have each individual that's either here in person or online come up and speak first before the board decides to get in any further discussion. But again, it's entirely up to the board.
I have a question. On the EDA, would you tell me, Tim Hodge, I believe, was on that last one. Has that changed?
I don't believe he was on the EDA. I know he submitted for the finance board, I believe, and the...
I thought he did both. Can you check that,
Caitlin? Let's see. Caitlin's looking right now. Ag Forestal, which he was appointed to last meeting, finance board, and then the planning commission. So he does not have a check mark for EDA.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Alrighty, first up is Community Policy and Management Team, CPMT.
So I'm not sure if Ms. Winfrey or Mr. Key are either here in person or in Zoom. Okay, and Mr. Moeller, who is the CSA coordinator, has indicated that they're not, so, yeah.
Okay, good evening. Of the two appointees, CPMT is recommending that Sandra Winfrey be reappointed.
at their meeting on May 24th. They formally recommended, or they formally approved that recommendation. She's been with us for the past 2 years and has been a very crucial component of CPMT. She brings a wealth of clinical experience as well as practical knowledge of the county, as she's also a resident. She's also a resident of her county as well. So I would encourage board supervisors to reappoint Sandra Winfrey for another 2 year term.
So anyway, for the board, yep, there's two appointments, Ms. Winfrey or Mr. Key. Ms. Winfrey is the current incumbent.
I got a procedural question, and I'm fine with it either way. And I almost feel like over the last couple of meetings we've been kind of inventing what this process is going to be, and not relation to it being him in particular. Is that part of our process, that somebody can come up and speak for and say, here's what we're suggesting or who we'd like to have?
It's not a public hearing, Mr. Chair.
Right.
It's not a public hearing.
So it's not allowable. Is that
Again,
I don't have a problem that he did it. It's a procedural question.
In this case, the speaker was associated with the county organization that was involved.
Yeah, I mean, so CPMT is the organization that oversees CSA, Children's Services Act. And so,
to be on it.
Yeah. And so just the CPMT board made a recommendation, and Mr. Mueller was just bringing that information forward to the board.
I would like to support Chris in what he's saying, procedural. We're getting more and more people signing up. In the past, sometimes we didn't. And we have more and more people signing. We need to make sure that these people have opportunity to come for us and speak.
Well, I think that's what they said in the beginning.
And so, we need to probably make a
They invited. I think you said y'all invited everyone to come and speak if they wanted.
Yeah, we.
Yeah, I know that. I understand. I understand that. I think we ought to really talk to them and say, if you're interested, we would like for you to come and meet the board.
Yeah, I mean, Ms. Solis, when she.
I just ask them. I mean, we have to make it. We come. And sometimes if they're not interested, they won't come.
So you're saying we should make it a requirement to come before the board to speak?
Yeah, we did for the planning commission a few years ago. And now that's in the future.
From now forward, that we make them. Yeah. The only problem I have with that is if they have extenuating circumstances.
Well, they can tell us.
Make sure they let us know.
Yeah. Right.
Any other thoughts from any of the other board members about that?
I guess so we're saying to require that every applicant make
if they want to be an applicant, they come to before us just so we can put a name with a face if we don't know them.
Yeah, I want to know people.
You say we do that with the planning commission?
We
it's
did
a requirement?
That.
No, I don't know if we made it a requirement. I don't think we made it.
Remember Joe Creasy came and the lady came.
I know that they came, but I think we opened the door up and offered them the opportunity. We didn't make it a requirement.
Yeah. I don't remember a requirement.
Let's think about it, maybe.
I mean, if the board wants a requirement, I mean, we can certainly look at the bylaws or how it's done.
I think it sort of precludes that if you're interested in the position that you would make the effort to show up. If you're not here, then that speaks in itself to some degree. You know, I'm not saying that that's always the case. You can have a very qualified candidate for whatever reasons, extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, something comes up.
Mr. Sheridan said, doesn't show up, but in general, I don't know that I would require, but strongly encourage candidates to come and speak and share their ideas as to why they think they're the right candidate for that board.
All right. Real quick, I just want to clarify with one more question on this, to my original question. So then we can have a representative from EDA come and speak and say, here's who we think you should point to the EDA, and we could have somebody from Piedmont come and say, here's who we think you should appoint. And is that what we're saying, that we want every time there's an appointment to be made, that we want a representative from them coming to us and saying, here's who we want? And again, this has nothing to do with you, this pure procedural.
I don't think that's what we're saying.
I mean, they can state their wants, but then not have who we have to go with.
Right.
Last time, I can't remember who it was, but we put somebody on board, and they stood up and said we'd like to have the same ones back.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that says that they can or they cannot, but if the board says we don't want that appointed body or board or advisory committee making a recommendation, we can certainly make that a...
I'm even okay with it. That's what we're saying. We're good with it. I'm foreseeing a time where suddenly every one of these has somebody stepping up making recommendations, and I think it's a good recommendation, and I agree with them.
I think there were two different questions. One was, should applicants for the position speak, and the second one was, should there be a policy with regard to representatives or the position of that board at large in terms of whether they recommend a particular candidate?
Mr. Chair,
I think that's two different things.
Yes, Ms. Harris.
Very often, if it's an outside board, so not our board, but JABA, for instance, we will get a recommendation from the director that just comes as an email generally and says we would advocate strongly for the reappointment of this person. And it generally does happen with reappointments, not so much original appointments. It's somebody that they've had on there for a while.
Oh, it was the library board.
The library board.
Last time.
So we do often get those, and if those emails come through, they're included with the board packet, so you can see those recommendations. Not so much in person advocate for that, but that is fairly standard to get those from whoever that other board or staff person is.
The emails or letters.
The emails, and we've gotten a few letters as well, I think.
Yes.
We've gotten those as well, so we do try to pass those along. So it's not out of character to have those. I don't remember one where we've actually had it during a board meeting, but it's not out of character to have those.
You know, anybody can send a letter to the board saying, or an email, I think you should do X. But I'm just, and I can leave it alone for now, but when it comes as a part of our procedure during a meeting, I'm just...
Can we have someone put procedure together and write it?
Yeah, I mean, if the board doesn't want, if they don't want an in-person, speaker, if it's more of just a letter or a recommendation, we can certainly do that, and then we can look at what the procedure is for.
And I don't think that was planned. I think that was kind of by accident.
Oh, I get it. Yeah.
Mr. Dahl called his name out.
And I'm not even saying I don't want that.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to be sure we have a policy that says,
it's fair.
Maybe that's something we can review and discuss next time.
And can I add one more thing, Mr. Chair? Resumes may not be necessary. What you think about resumes may not be necessary? Resumes for a lot of your information there for everybody to see. Or maybe we need different questions.
You don't want resumes?
They can put down their experience, but not full resumes. And you can have a question that they can put down all of their experiences that relate to this particular thing.
I personally would like to see the resume stay.
You do?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're saying you don't want
it? I don't think so. That's
fine. I mean, there's some people that can apply and don't turn one in.
But I think it
makes it a lot better for us to be able to see if we don't know them. And
that's just me.
There's some people we don't know. And I don't know. It's appreciative to have that to be able to go through it. I'll use Mr. Dunning. Mr. Dunning was from my district. And we had no idea he had 30 years with the Corps of Engineers. All right. So let's get back up here to Community Policy and Management Team. Are there any comments or questions about Ms. Winfrey or Mr. Key?
I emailed Moselle asking, since she's on it, what her thoughts were, and I agreed with what she said, that Mrs. Winfrey clearly is a strong member of that program, and it sounds like maybe even stronger than I realized.
Looking at her background, that's all she's done. Now, I will say this for Mr. Key. He's been a mentor in the county, and he's a lifelong resident.
Mm-hmm.
He was on my first football team I coached.
Yeah, and he has a strong background too.
Mm-hmm.
And his mentoring program is used back in this policy.
Right.
Often.
So, anybody else? So I've heard Ms. Winfrey twice.
I would go with the recommendation of the board on that one. I mean, I think Mr. Keyes qualified as well.
Like I said, Ms. Eager. So, all right. So, Ms. Winfrey. Now, Economic Development Authority at large. We're looking for three. Mr. Garcia, would you like to speak? I saw you here.
Hello, Supervisor. Rudy Garcia, 802 Vanderwoods Drive, Fort King, Virginia. I'd like to take this time to share a brief timeline of the EDA and highlight some of our accomplishments and activities since I've had the opportunity to serve as co-chair and now chair of that organization. First, I'd like to lay some background for context. Between July of 15 and June of 18, when I joined the board, the previous EDA directors had very little actual engagement in the business community. They acted as a conduit for the Quad County business seminars, had a couple of annual meetings, and acted as a pass-through for one shovel-ready project. Additionally, they hosted two small business appreciation dinners. That was the entire activity for those 3 years. Starting in July of 2018, I advocated for a mechanism where we could communicate more directly with the business and local larger community. I was successful, and in December of 2018, we formed a partnership with the Fermanagh Chamber and the County Economic Development Office to achieve best pricing and have been running weekly or bi-monthly ads in the Fermanagh Review as the Fermanagh Business Corner ever since. This has allowed more of the community to know what is going on with Fermanagh businesses. It was right around the time we got that approved, early 2019, all of the previous members, with the exception of myself and Mr. Putnam, decided it was time for them to move on from the EDA. So effectively, we've reconstituted the entire EDA since January, February 2019. Since then, the EDA has taken a much more active role at being engaged in the business community. We worked with the County Parks and Rec to buy signage for Pleasant Grove to address concerns we heard about visitors not knowing where to go when we leave the park to go visit local businesses. When the pandemic started, we immediately worked in collaboration with the Economic Development Office and set up weekly meetings with the Chambers of Commerce and the Economic Development Offices in Louisa, Green, Madison, Goochland, and Powhatan to learn and share best practices as our business communities struggled with how to pivot and adapt to the ever-changing environment. We also held weekly or bi-weekly town hall meetings with the Central Virginia Small Business Development Center to keep our local businesses updated and apprised of those best practices. Once stimulus money became available, we started working with small businesses to provide them the information and resources they needed to apply for both EIDL and PPP funding. Had we not done that, I suspect many of our businesses would not have been able to take advantage of those opportunities. We worked with the Community Investment Collaborative and helped spread the word about the small business disaster funding made available through the CARES Act, and worked to identify and assist those small businesses to obtain that funding. We purchased and provided hand sanitizer for 30 local businesses. We applied for and obtained a grant from the Charlottesville Community Area Foundation to provide assistance and training to small women and minority-owned businesses in Fermanagh County. With the proceeds of that grant, we provided scholarships to 14 Fermanagh businesses to attend the entrepreneur training course provided by CIC. Additionally, we held the first ever Fermanagh business pitch competition, and with the help of the CIC, we're able to award 5 businesses with a total of $11,000 in grants or forgivable loans. 2 of the board members here sat on that and were judges. Finally, we helped support and sponsor the first small business community fair, where we had a number of businesses set up so that the public could learn more about what was available in Fermanagh County. We did that in collaboration with the Fermanagh Leaders for Diversity and Equity. The current EDA is dedicated to remaining active and engaged in our local business community. While our primary function for years has been to act as a conduit for funds passing from the county to local businesses for incentives and providing bond guarantees, this EDA also sees a huge need for us to be involved with the is encouraging and supporting small, locally owned businesses to allow them to grow, thrive, and remain in Savannah County. I've been privileged to have been the co-chair and now chair as we made this transition from a check-passing entity to an organization that is actively involved in economic development. It would be a privilege to continue what we've started for the next 4 years. Thank you for your consideration.
Subject to your questions, that's it.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Putnam, are you present or online? I think so.
I don't see him online. Okay.
Mr. Brian Miller.
Again, don't see him online.
Ms. Brittany Gray. Absolutely.
Good evening. I'm Brittany Gray. We'll still share our address.
Yeah, I mean, you can.
To WhatsApp Circle in Riverside. So I would be new to the board, and I would like to propose being on it for several reasons. One, I'm actually part of the Community Investment Collaborative. I'm an alum from the program during COVID, mentioned by Brady Garcia. I'm a full-time student at Liberty School of Hounds for the government school. I own a moving company. I'm also a full-time realtor. I currently work with Stanley Martin. I'll be bringing 200 new families here next year with Colonial Circle. And I'm a mom of three. I went to Flaviana High School. Well, I went to Flaviana Central all the way up. I love to organize community events, and I would like to be involved in a larger level than I've done in the past, by being able to help businesses grow and continue to see growth in this area, not only for my clients, but also family and friends and neighbors. So that's pretty much it.
Thank you very much. All righty, next is Mr. Josh Bauer. Is he online by chance?
No, there's one phone. Phone that's calling in, but we're not quite sure who it is. We can try and maybe you can let the one last speaker, and then we'll see if that's
okay. And Ms. Peggy Shanklin, I think I just saw her online.
I did too.
Oh, no, she's here. I swear, I thought I just popped up on
her. Are we up there? Okay. Peggy Shanklin, 865 Jefferson Drive, Lake. I have been there since November 1st, 2001. I've been a small business entrepreneur since 2006. I am currently a realtor with Long & Foster. I have been involved in, women in business. We are currently 76 people strong. Those are paid members. We have over 200 women in business. We just started that, I believe it was August last year. I'm involved with the Lake Monticello Doers, and we are reaching out to new members of Lake to get them involved, not just with Lake events, but also the county. I'm involved with NTAC, the Farmers Market. I started that last year, and I believe it was the first part of August. We're up to 24 full-time vendors, and hundreds of people come see us during the month. We are working on marketing that to get those numbers up even more. I'm involved with the village people. I didn't see it. Pickleball, we are growing that as well, and currently we are out numbering the places to play here at the lake, so that's something else that we're looking for, is more places and opportunities. In the past I've worked with PAC, which is the school. I've worked with POM, which is Parents of Lake Monticello, which is a student group, the Lions Club, Rotary Club for a short period of time, and various other organizations. I just really love our county, and I'm business-minded, and that's what I want to do to help serve. Any questions?
Thank you, ma'am. Did you ever find out who the other number is?
They're not unmuting.
Yeah, they're not unmuting. I'm not sure.
That's bad. No, that's whose name I saw.
It's Valerie. It's not Valerie, right?
No.
She's there.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're not on YouTube.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we need three different positions.
Yep.
Open the floor to comments.
I think there's opportunity in this organization to start introducing some new people into community service and looking at some of these resumes and talking to a couple of these people. I feel like there's a healthy list of people here to try a new level of service to the community. There's some people in the community that have been serving for a long time on a lot of committees, and in the case of, for example, Brittany Gray, I haven't known Brittany long, but I know she's from here. I know she returned back to Flamanna with her family, and that she's anxious to get involved. I applaud Peggy getting involved. Peggy's been in the county a long time, and we just appointed her, I think, to head TAC, last week?
Maybe
a month ago. I look at people like Josh Bauer. I wish I had a chance to talk to him. I couldn't find how to reach him, but and he's got a sharp resume, as does Ryan Miller. So I think there's some opportunity to bring in new blood into community service in Flamanna.
Well, I'll speak to Josh. He's one of our engineers. Correct? Not architects. I'm using the wrong word. Yep. He's one of our architects. And I like the fact that he's done a lot of the stuff in somewhere else in Pennsylvania, and he really just wants to get involved down here somehow. So I know he wasn't here. That's all I'll say to that.
I certainly think Mr. Garcia has served EDA very well and serves the community. Yes, he is involved with a lot of different groups, but that can be viewed as an asset, not necessarily as a negative. It's a shame Curtis isn't here. He's been on there for a while as well, too. It would be good for him to speak. I'm glad that both Brittany and Peggy were here to speak on their behalf, and I'm comfortable with those choices there. Impressive resumes across the board. I guess it's a little bit about a balance, and what are you looking for in terms of the overall structure of the board and the decisions that they make, and how does that benefit the thinking of that board together? I think experience matters, but I think new faces and new ideas matter as well too. So personally, I would be comfortable with Mr. Garcia, Mrs. Gray. I'll put those two out there right now, and I think Mrs. Shacklin would also be very good too. That's my thoughts on that. And I wouldn't take it away from anybody else. It's just kind of my list of them.
I have a question, and I should know the difference, and I'm sure I do, but just you're thinking about the difference between EDA and EdTech.
So EdTAC, EdTAC is an advisory board, and so certainly there with the EDA, there are some more statutory requirements and a little bit more of a formal proceeding for what they do. I mean, so from an EDA standpoint, again, they assist if there's any outside agencies looking to do any any pass-through financing or utilizing the county's existing unavailable or unused bond, tax-exempt bonds or anything like that. So the EDA does that. The EDA has, as Mr. Garcia noted, they act as a conduit for a lot of different types of transactions. The county used the EDA when we were doing the CIC grants, pass-through of the grant funds. The EDA is also often used for a lot of agreements that the county necessarily can't do directly.
Right.
For instance, the Colonial Circle, the affordable, the workforce housing, the tax rebates, That funnels, that passes through the EDA, and I'm sure there's some others, like Firefly and some things like that.
My best question.
Yes.
I'll make a better question, I think. Don't they work together and rely on each other somewhat?
EDA and EdTech?
Or does EdTech just work with us?
No, I mean, there may be a little fall over a little bit, but not a ton. I mean, EdTech deals with more like, you know, kind of intimate county projects and stuff like that. You know, for instance, EdTech, they're working on Admission Mech. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, Mr. Spitzer said, you know, that they worked on the Village of Palmyra sign that the board just approved last meeting. So they're working on kind of more
individual projects.
Individual smaller projects, you know, and making recommendations to staff and you know, so it's from an economic development and tourism standpoint, whereas EDA is a little more, got a little more formal meat behind it. So
are any of these members, these folks members of EdTech?
Yes, Peggy.
Yes, yeah.
We just put Peggy on.
Yeah.
And that's the only one?
Yeah, he's the new.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what I'm just trying to get at, to get as many people involved as we can.
I also think, like, as far as Brian Miller and Joshua Bauer go, I mean, we're sitting here last couple of meetings trying to figure out ourselves what the whole, and have discussions about whether people stand up and give a presentation, do they submit a resume, and so on. I don't know that those two people would. So did they get? You said they did get an email saying they could make a presentation.
Oh yeah, well not. I mean, yeah, we've always let individuals know that they're more than welcome to come to the board and speak. You know, on the evening that the. That the appointments are being made.
Okay. I was also looking, so Curtis, I didn't realize Curtis, has he only ever been on the Economic Forum or EDA?
No.
He's on more than just
EDA. He was on the Partnership for Aging.
He stepped down.
He did step down, but yes.
Partnership for Aging, he stepped down.
Yes. Yeah.
So, what I was wondering about, and with what Rudy said, there's been absolutely great progress in the EDA. At the same time, Rudy has, as he stated in his application, gosh, he's been chair of the chamber, the EDA, the leadership class. We just reappointed him. Last meeting to finance board, and it looks like to me if we're going to try to break appreciation for everything Rudy's doing, if we're going to try to introduce new positions, if it was Curtis for Rudy, and Curtis is only doing one thing, and I think has been co-chair.
Yes.
Current chair.
No, but has been co-chair.
Co-chair.
Yes. I believe so. I don't really.
It was chair.
Okay. Yeah.
It was chair.
So I just, again, with all great respect for everything Rudy's been doing, trying to get other people involved, I think if Curtis stayed, and we got a big has, and Josh Bauer just has a heck of a resume.
I think everything that to take the sitting chair of a committee and somebody who's been as actively involved in this community is you know, not really appropriate, especially when in his involvement with that committee, he really has pushed it forward and driven it. So I would be against not having Mr. Garcia continue on the EDA board. I just think he adds a lot of value, and it's okay if you're involved in many things. That just means that you create a lot of connections. It's wonderful to have people that are participating, but it's also important and valuable to have people that are connected at many various levels. And, you know, Mr. Garcia is certainly connected, very, very plugged into the business community and to the Fluvac community at large. So I like Mr. Putnam as well, too, but I'm strongly in favor of maintaining Mr. Garcia.
Yeah, I am too, because I think he has all the knowledge, and if we put some new people, they, you know, people be able to guide them, and they'll be able to pick up from him. You know, in the past, we used to automatically put people back on boards and commissions if they wanted to get back on.
If they were incumbents.
But I don't think we've ever had this many.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
This has been miserable to try and do each year because we've had so many wonderful applicants. But Ms. Eager, did you have something you wanted to say?
I think Mr. Garcia is the leader.
Okay.
Before he came on, he's right, very little in having any direction.
Okay. Well, that's three people. So that one's decided.
Well, that's one.
That's one. We've got to get two more.
Yeah.
I'd also like to speak for Joshua Bauer. I don't know him, but you said you know him.
Yeah, he's come here before us to speak. Remember the winery, the one who wanted to buy the winery last year? That's Josh Bauer. Yeah, the young man. No, it ended up falling through. He wanted to buy the one in Scottsville. He came and spoke to us. Yeah, he's also spoken to us because he's the one that did the plans for the basement, yeah.
Okay.
Over here.
Okay.
Smaller guy with glasses.
Yep. Wears
a bow tie all the time.
Dark hair.
Just don't ask him to build scaffolding.
Okay.
He did his homemade scaffolding. It didn't work though. Well, Brittany and Josh?
I would go for that.
Brittany and Josh?
I'm okay with Brittany. I think I would probably pick Curtis over Josh, but that's just me.
Well, I mean, Curtis is from my district. He's done a great job. You really can flip a coin. The one that stuck out to me the most was Josh when I read the resume and everything else that he's been a part of and doing it.
I agree.
All right. So I think we decided on the others and Brittany and Josh. So next up is Piedmont Virginia Community College Board, Dr. Fred Lang.
Thanks for allowing me to come and talk to all of you. I've been on the leadership course, took the leadership course, and I've also been on the ETAC committee for a couple of years and enjoyed that. My entire career has been about education. I've had 30 plus years of teaching online for various universities around the country. I was the director of training for the U.S. Department of Commerce in Washington for a dozen years. And I think what I can bring to the board and to Fluvanna County is leverage virtual and online learning with residential learning so that every student has the same chance as anyone else to be educated. So that's the kind of unique background that I have, and that I look forward to your appointment. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Edna Harris. Is Ms. Harris online?
Unless she has the phone number, that's the only.
And if they're not unmuting, there's not a whole lot we can do.
Yeah.
I see Ben in the back. Ben Shaw.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair of the Board. Good afternoon, Ben Shaw, 4608 Venable Road. That's good to see those of you who don't know him very well, and those of you. I appreciate your consideration of my application. I am a resident of Louisa, but having traveled the country and also the world, I actually immigrated to the county of Hills. I'm a graduate of PVCC, as are all of my siblings, all three of them. It's also my expectation my children, two of them will be later attending PVCC themselves. I have a vested interest in that institution being an institution that represents the workforce needs of Levan, as well as Louisa and the surrounding area, that evolves as UVA to Sentara and all the other major employers in Charlottesville have changing workforce needs. But it also needs to represent the county in such a way that people can go there, get the training they need, return, and actually live off of what they're making. So I'm not an education background. Looking at the applicants on the list right now, I'd say any one of them would be a fantastic addition to this board. Any one. But my simple pitch, my kids are going to go there in your future. I want it to be good bang for my buck or their buck. And I want it to be something that lands some jobs or helps them transition to the next step for you. I've been there, I have a quarter century history, personal relationship with UVC. I've been there, graduated, came back on multiple occasions. My wife has worked there. So I love the place. I still actually maintain mentor relationships with at least one of my old professors from many years ago. So I love your consideration, but I certainly yield to all the other smart people in this as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Next up is Valerie Powell Mountain. I know she's on the line.
She is.
Oh, she's the phone number, I think.
Hi. Yep.
Hey, it is.
Hey, this is Valerie. Hey, I'm here. Hi, Valerie Powell Mountain, 17 Fleetwood Drive, Palmyra. As you probably know, I worked at PVCC as the Dean of Workforce Services for 17 years. I'm sorry, 16 years, and retired just a year ago. Before that, I was also in education in the community college system in Pennsylvania. And I also have a 20-year career in business. So I bring a lot of experience, not only in education, particularly in community college, but I also bring a lot of experience in workforce development. My interest is that there are a lot of changes going on at PVCC right now, which you probably know about, with Frank Friedman. Dr. Frank Friedman is retiring next month, and they hired a new president. There are some changes already happening in senior management, and I just look at the experience that I've had, particularly in workforce development, and think that I might be able to help the new president transition in learning about our community, the Charlottesville area, particularly Savannah County, and also to help the college develop workforce programs that are more appropriate for Savannah County. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was instrumental in starting up Kids College at Savannah, which was very, very successful. And the kids loved it, and the college loved it, and we saw a lot of the kids go on to become matriculated college students. So I do agree with the speaker previously who said that any of the candidates would be excellent. I'm very pleased that so many good candidates have applied for being on the board. But I would be honored to be considered if you decide to select me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Next up is Charles Hayden Thomas Parrish. I keep putting that. Oh, there you are.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. My name is Hayden Parrish, and as many of you know, I served as a college advisor at Savannah County High School from 2018 to 2020, where in my work there, both years, 25 to 30% of the graduating class went to PVCC, so I became quite familiar with what students were looking for, what drove them to PVCC, what they hope to gain from it, and I've kept up with many of them since then, and their experience at PVCC. After that, I went and earned my master's in education, and I just signed my contract and will be working as a school counselor at the high school next year, Levan County High School. I look forward to continuing to support our future students in their post-secondary planning. And of course, if appointed to the PVCC College Board, I will incorporate my professional experiences as well as our students' experiences in the PVCC's strategic planning to ensure that our students and community continue to be the best served by PVCC as possible. So thank you so much. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Happy deciding.
Thank you, sir. Welcome to our world. We got five quality candidates.
Yes.
All righty, I'll open the floor. Any comments or?
Well, in my opinion, two candidates stand out. That would be Ms. Palamountain and Mr. Lang. That's not to say that the rest of the candidates aren't excellent. I would certainly love to see Hayden's youth on the board. I think that could be a plus. Mr. Shaw, with his experience in terms of being 25-year veteran of the system, also offers a lot. But when you look at the sort of depth of educational experience and involvement at higher levels, Mr. Lang stands out, as does Mrs. Palamountain. And so those would be my two preferences for the candidates with benefits on both sides. And Mr. Lang brings an outside viewpoint, having come from, I believe, California, if that's right. Ms. Palamountain, of course, has a lot of inside knowledge, which, as she mentioned, could help in the transition with the new board, and was certainly instrumental in tying to the band out with PVCC as well, too. So I think those are the candidates, in my opinion, that stand out the most and would probably add the most value.
I'm sitting here, and one of them was in my youth group, and the other one told me he's a 25-year veteran. I'm going, my God, that makes me old, because I've known him for about 10 years now, and we all know his dad. I remember his dad working here. When I read Dr. Lang's resume, that was. All of them are impressive, but
yes. And I went back and tried to decide and looked at the PMOC manual and looked at kind of like the job description of what the board members are expected to do to try to get my head wrapped around it, and I was with Dr. Lang and Paul Mountain, Valerie is right there, and Shaw.
We have lots of talent.
Thank you to all of you. Mr. Fairchild, Ms. Eager, y'all, anything y'all want to add?
This is really tough.
They're all,
we just have a different kind of
criteria. Besides Stoneman, a fishbowl,
yeah.
I communicated some with Valerie and had known her a lot over the years, and on one side would look at it and say the same thing I was saying earlier. Valerie has done a lot, and Dr. Lang, boy, that's a strong resume. Again, everybody, but that's a mind that we would want at the table. With that said, Valerie makes, I think, a really strong point that in this transition with Dr. Friedman leaving, that having a base of who's going to know more about how Piedmont functions and good and so on, the organization, and Valerie having been a part of it and now a board member helping to transition the new director into it, I think it's a unique point in time regarding Valerie's need or importance to that board.
In the policy, did you read, there was a statement about they did not hire people who worked there. Did Valerie fall under that? I didn't quite understand.
They couldn't be on the board?
Right, could not be a board.
Well, that's probably if she was a current employee.
Oh, it said, I read it different. I don't know. You all have. And it says, about 2007, I didn't get it.
I thought it said current employee.
Parent employee.
And also that you couldn't be a public official.
Yeah.
Right. Those were the two that stood out.
Oh, I know that. I saw the parent before I met, but let me, y'all read it.
Yeah, I don't think it.
I just want to read it. That I wasn't misinterpreted. Don't want to.
While she's looking, Mrs. Eager, do you have some thoughts?
Did you want to add something?
It's very difficult. decision. I've been on ATAP with Dr. Wright, and he's a lovely person, and I work hard. And now they give great service.
All right.
May I read what the board manual says? So this is the Virginia Community College System Policy Manual 2.1.4, paragraph C. Additionally, no former full-time employee of the community college shall be eligible to serve on the college board. Local college board members serving as of March 2007 who were former full-time employees of the community college would be eligible to serve out the remainder of their current term and be eligible for one additional consecutive term. All members of the college board shall be deemed members at large, charged with the responsibility of serving the best interests of the whole region.
It says no former full-time employee.
Certainly does seem...
That's a good catch, Ms. Booker.
And this is from a revised edition May 4th, 2011.
Well, given that, I think that Mr. Lang is his choice.
Do we have head nods on that agreement?
Is that the right interpretation?
Well, you want to read it one more time?
Let me take it down to the county attorney.
Oh, man. He probably wrote it.
No, I didn't.
That's right. It didn't say 1876.
I just needed to look at it.
Well, it's one sentence. It seems to be pretty categorical. Yeah. Says, additionally, no former full-time employee of the community college shall be eligible to serve on the college board.
Well, that's pretty simple. I wanted to make sure that that's what I heard.
Yeah, that's what you heard.
Yep.
Just to clarify, I want to clarify that Valerie was a full-time employee. I mean, to me, it kind of goes without saying, but Valerie, I think, is still on there. Can we...
If Valerie, would you mind unmuting?
She's still there.
She's still there. Up there she goes.
Hello.
Hey, Ms. Bowmountain.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We just need to clarify whether or not...
I was not aware of that restriction. I'm sorry.
And you were a full-time employee, correct?
Yes.
I was a full-time employee, yes.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm just glad we caught it before we made the mistake. All righty. So,
Mr. Lang.
Yes, Mr. Lang. So we got, all right, got Mr. Lang down there. We've got Rudy, Brittany, and Josh. And then we have Ms. Cassandra with.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the following Board of Commission or Committee appointments: Community Policy and Management Team, Vendor Rep, Cassandra Winfrey; Economic Development Authority at Large, Rudy Garcia; Economic Development Authority at Large, Brittany Gray; Economic Development Authority at Large, Joshua Bauer. I can't read the terms, I'm sorry, I'm backing out on that. For four years.
2 years on the first.
Effective 7/1/12. Oh, they're all for 4 years.
No, two years on the first.
2 years for Ms. Winfrey.
Yep.
And for the remainder, for the Piedmont Virginia Community College Board, Citizen Representative Dr. Fred Lang. Those are all from 7/1/2022 to 6/30/2026.
Got a motion made by Mr. O'Brien. Seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye.
Thank you to all the strong candidates.
I can tell you right now, I do not remember in, I think this is 10 years I've been on the board, ever having to be this difficult.
You're right, yeah.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
I promise you, I'm not just saying that, guys. When you've got six people up there, four or five, usually we look at it like we're going, okay, let's get one.
We don't stream
lighting. Alrighty. Presentations. C, Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission Regional Hazard Mitigation Plan Update. Ian Baxter.
Hey, y'all. How are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing, Ian?
My name is Ian Baxter. I'm a regional planner at the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. Mr. Bell, are you going to be scrolling?
Yep, just let me know.
Yeah, sure. I'm here to talk to y'all today about the current hazard mitigation plan update for 2023. We're currently in the midst of that. I wanted to come before y'all before we come to you later with an actual, asking you to adopt the actual plan. But I'm happy to talk through the process, talk about some of the data we use to make our determinations, or that the working group used to make their determinations, and then sort of give you the next steps. So, next slide. So the purpose of the Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan, it has a few separate purposes. I'd say the main purpose in terms of y'all's interest is that FEMA requires natural NHMPs as condition for eligibility to receive certain mitigation program funds and grants. And so as the regional planning district, we conduct this plan update on behalf of our six member localities, member jurisdictions. But essentially the plan itself, in addition to helping FluVanna receive funds if necessary, also is a document that basically documents where natural hazards happen, how severe they are, as well as provide space for localities to designate or put in specific mitigation action items. And so these are the six required sections. I'm going to briefly talk through each of them before I can answer any questions if y'all have them. But essentially, the plan requires that there's an outline of the actual process used, a profile of the region that it's covering. The hazard identification analysis, also known as the HIRA, is the sort of the information about potential hazards, as well as the ranking of their significance or risk to the region. A vulnerability and capabilities assessment, which basically determine how damaging some of these events could be if they occur in the region, with some modeling tools provided by FEMA. And a capability assessment determines how ready a locality is to react or respond to these events. And this mitigation strategy is a list of action items that each locality will take to address natural hazards over the next 5 years. So just a brief look at the timeline. If you shift your focus to the far right, we are actually, today is June 1st, so the draft plan became available on the TJPDC website today. It will be open for a month for public comment. I'd be happy to share with you all the link to that. But before this, we basically had to create our working group or assemble our working group, which is a mandated feature of this plan. There's a member of each locality, primarily emergency management personnel or planning department personnel from each of our six member governments or member counties and the city that serve on this working group, and they're the folks that determine the HIRA, which is the ranking of the key hazards, as well as work through the goals and objectives of the plan and conduct an annual review in every May. We've conducted a public survey, we've had a public event in February. We've also gone and met with local staff at all the member localities to talk through mitigation action items. The HIRA, which I was basically describing earlier, it's essentially a matrix of all the natural hazards that affect the planning districts. Some of the data, which we can scroll through briefly, informs the working group. Basically, each of the localities submitted a ranking. If you can go to the next slide. Every locality contributed one of these, and this is the aggregate HIRA that we put together from those scorings. I will say, while some of the numbers, the rankings of the probability, human impact, property impact, and business impact changed slightly from the 2018 plan. This is essentially the same order. The only major difference is FEMA required a communicable disease/pandemic section for obvious reasons in the actual plan itself, and so that came in at the fourth spot, but the rest of them were pretty much unchanged. And again, some of the data I'll go through in a moment, or I'll just provide an overview of the data we use. inform locality staff as they work through this, as well as their own knowledge of their own, you know, where they work, some of the calls that they receive, et cetera. And you can just, I mean, you can't really read any of this. I just wanted to give, you know, you guys, it's all in the plan, I promise. But essentially, we source our data from, and you can just scroll the next few slides of these. We source our data for these determinations from a variety of different federal, state, and local agencies. And I can just walk through a few of them: Department of Forestry, Health, Emergency Management, Conservation and Recreation, DEQ, Department of Energy, UVA, the CDC, NOAA, NASA, USGS, NWS. So we're working, PDC staff has worked really hard to compile all of this data to make it as recent as possible. You know, in some cases, we're getting probably about 2021 is the latest that we were able to access, but we present this basically to the working group, and each of those members goes back and confers with their staff, confers with community members, and gives us that hybrid matrix. And apologies on the formatting there, but again, the communicable disease chapter was entirely new. We worked really closely with the Blue Ridge Health Department as well as the Virginia Department of Health to get that accurate data. And if you want to just keep moving over to the vulnerability assessment. The next slide. So this is we use a software from FEMA called HAZIS, which models for hurricanes, earthquakes, and floods. And we also use some other data sources to generate estimated risk, but we're really looking at expected losses in human life and property damage. And so if you move to the next slide, this is one of the outputs from that HAZIS software. This is a modeling a hurricane event. And if you look closely, I guess on this screen, each of those colors represents potential estimate property damage. This is a measurement in thousands of dollars. And so this is modeled after Hurricane Fran, which happened in 1996, and it's the equivalent of an approximate 200-year event, which is basically the chances of this happening is one every 200 years. The next slide.
So do you mind me ask a question?
Yeah.
So in the center of that, of course, is a red spot in Flamana.
It's like
Monticello.
Like Monticello.
Okay. Thank you.
That's good. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. And this is just, we use HAZIS to also generate some flood maps. So this is town Scottsville. And again, these are estimated losses as well as the level, the depth that the flooding would occur on the banks of the James. But I just wanted to give you guys just a brief, sort of a quick overview of the type of data that we use. And if you keep going, there should be, this is a wildfire map generated from the Southern Wildfire Risk Assessment, which is a group, and again, these. It's a lot easier to read than the actual plan, I promise. The final thing I wanted to touch on is the mitigation actions that are contained within the plan. So we work with locality staff to generate these. So kind of the process that we have to go through is there's a full list that was included in the 2018 plan. We worked with the staff to determine, to kind of catalog that, to see what's been done, what's in progress, what's changed. This is a little table that each of those lives within, so to speak, and it basically outlines, you know, funding method, implementation schedule, and a ranking, a priority ranking. So we worked with Debbie Smith here in Flamana County on generating new action items, which are included in the packet. A lot of them were carried over from the 2018 plan. Some of their priorities changed, some of the priority ranking changed, some of the implementation schedule changed. But that was our primary point of contact here in Flamana. And then the next slide is, our next step. So again, I mentioned we have our public comment period happening here in the month of June. After we incorporate the comments and feedback we receive from not only the public accessing the document, but potentially boards and City Council of Charlottesville. And again, I'm going before all of the boards that would be adopting this ordinance in 2023. So all of our six member localities, as well as the towns housed in the planning district. We'll then submit to BNM and FEMA. They have a 30 and 45 day review period respectively. And then our work turns towards the formal adoption with localities. So we try and get an ordinance or resolution in front of y'all, in front of all the other planning district localities that would need to pass this to access that FEMA funding. But I would be happy to answer any questions if y'all have them, but that's kind of where we are right now.
I wasn't laughing at your plan when I laughed at the beginning, but I was looking down through there and I saw there's a pretty good chance we're going to have some windstorms.
Yeah.
I had trees fall almost on buses this year.
Yeah.
The heavy winter snow, they're still cleaning up trees.
Yeah, there's a reason those were tossed.
Yeah.
Were there any major changes between the last couple of years that you identified for Fluvanna working with the Fluvanna team here?
Nothing. I mean, I'm sure if I had more time to think about it, yes, nothing comes to mind. I mean, those risks, I mean, flooding, I think also, and that dam failure, I think, was brought up with I forget what the name of the dam was that almost...
Bagayo Dam.
So it's usually, I would say there's a certain element, I mean, kind of the point of it happening every 5 years, there's a certain element of recency bias, but basically whatever's occurring either most prominently or most frequently, so I would say that. Flooding, dam failure, and then the high wind storms.
And outside of Fluvanna, were there any risks that you identified in the TJBDC community that were sort of new and different?
I mean, I think we're seeing more frequent and severe storms as a general rule, you know, across the region. I would say that the one risk that didn't really change was wildfire risk. Didn't really change very much, and I think the primary place where that would occur is Green and Nelson. But I think we're seeing not only an increase in the heat, heat maps we were able to look at and some of the heat islands that we were able to identify in Charlottesville, but also I think the frequency and severity of some of the storms that we're seeing during the summer. But again, I am not a meteorologist or any of that. I just read the data. But smart people told me that. So.
All right. Anyone else? Thank you so Thanks very so much. Do appreciate it. And I will not bring up 69 and 72, those 500-year events within 3 years. Next up is D, Sheriff's Office Firing Range Improvements. Reserve Deputy Mel Sheridan and Sheriff Eric Hess. Looks like Major Wells.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Mel Sheridan, and it's been my privilege, frankly, to serve as a sworn reserve deputy now with the Sheriff's Department for 9 years. Most recently, the last four, there was a stint where we didn't have anybody at time, but I started under Sheriff Washington for 5 years, and then for four with Sheriff Hess, and it's simply been a pleasure. But that said, I've undergone, as every other reserve deputy has, required training for the first several years, particularly firearms training, that's what this is about. And for those first 4 or 5 years, we had a basic requirement, and then we all had to meet that, obviously, to be a part of the department and to perform the duties. But in the last 4 years, and probably prior to that, but since the reserve deputies have been back online with the department, it has been, the training has been some of the best I've ever received. My background has been in leadership and weapons training prior to being commissioned on my head. So I've had a lot of that, and I'll say this. The Sheriff's Department has an excellent weapons training team. I mean, I said it, I'll just refer to my notes because they're succinct. They're professionally dedicated, and they are thorough in every phase of training that they do. So in going through the training for the last few years, it became obvious that it's just a lot more than the basic requirements. They have got a lot of enhanced training on there, primarily moving as a team and transitioning from one area to another, first aid, triage, etc. They are long days. I would ask Mr. Dahl if you would to flip over to, I think it's the third slide there. I want to put it on there just to point out
the third slide.
Well, I thought you had the slide on the in-service training. If you don't have it, that's okay. What it boils down to is this. When we go to the range, we go at approximately 8 o'clock in the morning, and we're there to well past.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. If you look at the lower part of that, it's a 12-hour scenario, and that's not terrible in June, July, and August when you got long days. When you go in November, when you go in March, you're out there in the dark, starting, you're well past dark finishing. So here's what it boils down to. We've got more legwork. The facility we have is adequate. It's at the landfill or the recycle facility.
Convenient,
yes, ma'am. It's rudimentary. But it became pretty obvious after the last few years. It just needs some basic. So the reserve deputies thought we'd thought the city could initiate a little project to get the basics of just power and lights to the facility. I talked with the county team, with regard to what it might cost to do that. Mr. Dolphy, now I hate to ask you to back up to phase one, phase two. It's a small ask. It's approximately $6,000. It's $5,933. The sheriff and Major Wells, at the end of this, we're at the end of the fiscal year, looked at their budget. And collectively, the two phases, again, it's $5,900. It's a very small ask to give the basics of electricity and lights to the facility. If you get electricity, it gives you a couple options. You could actually put a small air conditioner out there in that small building. You could put a heater. You could have a lot of creature comforts, would be nice. So what I'm asking the board to do is come up with a $3,000 basically matches. The sheriff, the department looked at their end-of-year budget and found $3,850 that they've identified that they could move out of their year-end 22 money back to support this project and allow it to Public Works and to Ms. Dagman's team. Ms. Dagman's been great in working with me and to identify what the fix would be. It's not great. We have two buildings on the site that have electricity and service, not on the firing range, but in the general proximity. So just a matter of running underground conduit from one of those facilities to the firing range and then putting up some basic lighting. So what I'm asking for the board's consideration on, it almost seems like I'm under house arrest. Major Wells told me about, snatched me off as a, misstep. But what I'm asking is $3,000 of potential year-end funding be allowed to the Public Works to support this project. I and the reserve deputies and frankly the entire sheriff's department much appreciate your support in this undertaking. Do you have an answer to the question?
I have never seen that shooting range, and I live right across the street from. I can't hear anybody over there.
Yes,
y'all have that quiet gun.
It's over the hill.
It's at the very back of the landfill.
Yeah.
And it's also on the backside. It drops
right
off significantly, and it's probably 125 feet below grade of the landfill itself. The recycle center.
And they have white numbers.
Silence.
None of those. I can't emphasize enough. I mean, I spent 20 years in the military. Underwent a lot of weapons training, and it was good. The weapons training team that Sheriff has and Major Wells have are absolutely excellent. They go well above what's required to make it integrated and challenging. It's frankly, they don't cut you any slack. You got to meet the requirements, and I guess I'm the canary in the coal mine. If the old guy falls out, well, then maybe they can take a break because I am the older guy out there. But they could use these small changes to make it a much better facility. Electricity, frankly, eventually would lead to being able to have a better firing range so that you can actually get targets to turn and things like that.
Some question? To me, it's all... That's just a very small price to pay to make us better. Anybody got a question about that?
And safer.
That safer is under being better.
The lights are not on a pole or anything.
They're on a... we're proposing, yes, they are on a pole, but not an elevated pole.
Yeah.
Just a couple of 6x6s. Maybe 12 feet tall. And just simply light up the... And it's more than just the firing range because there's a lot of maneuvering. They use a couple of cars. And frankly, the training is very challenging. And it's a lot of firing challenging. So we work as a team.
And with the age of some of their reserve deputies, the liability, we'd help out by putting lights out there.
Like I said, the best weapons training I've ever seen, short of being in a coma.
Just curious, is there any type of regional facility for this shooting range?
No, everybody has their own, essentially. We use the Central Shenandoah Criminal Justice Academy, which is in near Harrisonburg. And their range is actually, I think, still at the Harrisonburg Convenience Center. I don't know if Harrisonburg calls it Convenience Center or not. As you know, it's quite a distance to go to Harrisonburg, trying to get the whole department there. So that's really, like when I first came here, we literally went from the backyard, attacked a target to the tree and shot at it. Not making that up.
Wow. So
what we have is nothing fancy. It's significantly better. And lighting would just improve that and make it more usable. We have to do night fire and low light fire. Right now, we just pull cars on there, trying to headlights and spotlights to try to get stuff illuminated. So this is really a good step towards making it just that much a little better.
And how long was that range also?
Do you have to do SWAT training?
We don't have SWAT
training. Just to let you know that Albemarle uses my farm, and they come out when they want to train the SWAT team. They do canine and car coaches and some shooting as well.
Yes, ma'am. It's just, there are other residents in the county that have been gracious to make their property available to different, like Major Well said, for years. It just simply took place in the backyard of one of the deputy's parents' house, because it's a basic requirement you have to get.
So, so how long has that range been there?
Oh, 6-7 years. 7 years, maybe. Mm-hmm. So we built it very slowly. The county was nice enough to give us the land. It is not impressive. It's basically a hillside with some stands put up where we have 2x4s that we stick in there and put targets on them. But at least it's a berm. It's maybe 8 lanes, 10 lanes wide. You know, we have it marked off for the distances. If you remember the training presentation I gave 7 months back about the state mandates, so we've been marked off for state mandated training, basically. So there's an old police car down there we use and a little bit of range for rifles, but it's really dirt with the hill.
Is the reason it hasn't come up before now just not wanting to ask too much at one time? Or is
correct.
A suggestion on frankly, the department's made it work. It is a very safe one. That is the one thing that's because it has a 75-foot high berm behind it. It's just, we saw a need, and honestly, we felt like it was not a big ask, and it would be a pretty significant improvement to a facility we have to have. And
we're slowly trying to do it. Like, for a while, we had no building or anything down there, and then we finally got it. Make up $1,000 with a metal portable loads for an awning. As we do training, we have to rent a porta potty, bring it out there, and be in compliance. So we're just gradually working with it.
It's just a need that we identified, and they got a lot of needs. So this one was something we thought we could take on, and I don't mind coming and asking for money on that. Sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. But I hope y'all will find it in your heart to do this, because this will significantly improve their ability to enhance the training. I know Mr. Dahl had asked if we defer it to, but that's why I came to see if there are any additional questions associated with this particular project.
Yeah, again, there's no decision necessarily. I mean, again, this is something that was kind of out of budget cycle, and the sheriff's office kind of brought it forward. I mean, so you certainly have options between, if you want to use the $3,000 from the sheriff's budget savings and then take $3,000, you take from the BOS contingency, you take it all from the BOS contingency. I mean, so there's a couple options to go from a funding standpoint. In the BOS contingency right now, there's $93,000 and some change in there right at this moment. So if the board wants staff to move forward, the funding, I mean, there's a funding stream there.
Mr. Speaker, what do you think? Ms. Booker?
Yes.
Fairchild?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if we could have done this in the budget season. But I understand
this is your salute to Mr. Weaver. Sitting in that chair. This is your salute to Mr. Weaver.
The answer is yes, we could have. But I didn't bring it to you during the budget cycle. But
probably wasn't thought about until.
That's right.
We were out there on a really cold, dark day, a 12-hour training plan. And again, you make it work. Yeah. Headlights and spotlights. But this would make it a much more down the road if there's initial, funds, they can enhance the range with power targets, but this would help a lot.
So what's the question?
Just whether or not we think this is a good idea to move forward with.
And whether or not to match it to provide the
money. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to is how we're talking about funding it.
Well, you use half sheriff's budget, which would transfer to Public Works, and then BLS contingency, or just use the whole BLS contingency for the whole thing.
We can do either one. I don't think we're taking money from anybody. If sheriff looked through there and said, I've got this extra, then he's got that extra.
I just wanted to clarify which of those two we were.
Yeah. The only reason I'm asking you now is because I won't be here at the next meeting.
Because what I'll do is I'll just put this on the net board's next agenda as a consent item. So if I've got some idea of which way the board is wanting to go, it won't necessarily have to be a discussion item next time.
Does anybody have are you splitting it or just us covering it?
I think it's a good idea to split it.
We covered it. Let's just split it right now because they're going to come back to us if they need anything else. Mr. O'Brien?
Split it.
Okay, so you got four of us that said split it.
And it'll come back on consent for split.
We've never told them no. I hate to say it this way. They've come and asked us for anything. So.
No, this Major is Wells. The Sheriff's Department. This is on reserve deputies. We just thought it was on me and we just got to feel. I kind of know how the system works, so we thank you very much.
Yep. Thank y'all. All righty, E, Children's Services Act semi-annual report, Mr. Muller.
Hello again.
Hello.
Okay. So I've been attending so far. Before I begin my presentation, I want to thank the board for following CPMD's recommendations and putting refunding taxes to our CPMD. She's, again, a great asset, so thank you all very much for that. That being said, it's been a long meeting, so I'll try to be brief and brilliant. Especially because I just found out I have a 3-year-old having a meltdown over not having his train, which is in my car right now.
Oh no.
Okay. So normally either myself or one of my predecessors used to come to the board in May or June and request more funding for the Children's Services Act because by statute, CSA is self-sufficient, meaning whatever is approved by CPMT spend or spend has to be covered by blending of state and local funding. Normally that would be an action item. However, today, that we will not be requesting any additional funding this year. It's the second year in a row that we've been able to do this. As you can see, we were given $3 million to spend this year. As of yesterday, we have approximately $173,000 remaining. We still have a month to go to for cases to request funding or whatnot. But on average, a case usually costs about $1,400 per month if there a new request comes up. So unless I get 100 requests for funding just for the month of June, I think we should be okay this year. But I also want to go over some of the trends, a couple of trends with that. So as you can see, this is a trend of spending for the past 14 years, with the high point of spending occurring back in fiscal year 17, which was the year prior to becoming joining the county's team as a CSA coordinator. Since then, through a combination of work with family assessment and planning team and CPMT, while also looking at how we can spend our money smarter, not harder, we've been able to steadily decrease that. However, in the past couple of years, we have seen some increases. This correlates pretty closely to what's happened out in the community as a result of the COVID pandemic that has been occurring since 2020. This year, we are expecting to have higher cost than average based on the trend. But the good news is that this year, we appear to have our spending appears to be relatively flat, which was actually came as a surprise to us because all other indicators of our way we've been spending our money would lead more towards us actually going slightly over budget this year. The next slide, and this shows a spending trend. It's got some peaks, it's got some valleys, but overall it's still a relatively flat amount month to month, and this is goes back from March of 2021 from the previous fiscal year up to last month, previous month, which ended yesterday. So, why is this being flat as a good thing? Well, I'm going to go to the next slide. Thanks. So, like I said, all indicators would suggest that we should be spending more money than we actually did. The amount of money we pay for educational day placements, which is when we have to send a child outside the county to be properly educated because their needs exceed what our public school system can provide that child, went up about 11%, which is about $100,000 difference. Plus, the number of kids or youth that we served this year went up by 20%. That's been a trend that's been happening in the past couple of years. Back in fiscal year 2020, we were serving approximately 65 children. As of this year, we are served about 117. That's a 40 to 45% increase. And usually when we see that increase in cases, we also see an equal increase in spending. This year, we've not seen that. What we've been seeing, though, is the cases that have been coming have been showing not necessarily a reduced amount of need, but we've been able to target the needs much more surgically so that we can go in, provide the help that these families need, get them to a good place, and then be able to pull back. So again, working smarter, not harder, which has been sort of like the objective that my office has been trying to pursue for the past few years. Go ahead, next slide. A couple things to keep in mind, though, and there is this slide is not 100% accurate now because if you look at the first item, where it talks about rate setting for private day schools, this was something that was put into the Appropriations Act from the General Assembly back in 2020. That basically stated that effective July 1st of this year, the Office of Children's Services, which is the state agency that sort of supervises and oversees all local CSA programs, they were required to set rates for these private day schools because that's been the biggest driver of increased costs statewide. If this rate setting were to have gone through, we would save money as a program, but any difference between what we could pay a school and what the school would be charging would likely have to be extracted from our public schools themselves. So we probably would have been, in all likelihood, as a locality, we probably would have had to end up paying a larger share than we have been in the past few years. There was an item in the state budget this year that would defer that rate setting for 1 year, so that this year, the rates that the schools would be charging, and there wouldn't be any issues with these schools trying to get the difference from our public schools. As of right now, the General Assembly has adopted the state budget that actually defers this for 1 year. It's not quite there yet. The governor still has to sign the budget, but if he does sign the budget, then indications point to yes on that one, then that first issue will not be a concern. The second item, however, is a concern, and this is from House Bill 2117 from the General Assembly session back in 2021. So, for years, CSA has always paid for private day placements for the schools, which has been a pretty big driver of expenses. About 2 years ago, the General Assembly decided that funding should no longer be administered by CSA, and the legislation has directed a big task force to figure out a way to redirect that funding to the Department of Education. Now, granted, this would reduce our program's budget by about 35 to 40%. However, the question comes up is when this money gets transferred over to the schools, what would be the local match at that point? Right now, there is a proposal in the task force that instead of using the current match rate that's used for CSA services, that the comprehensive rate that's currently used for local state sharing of school funding be used instead. That actually has a lower match rate than what we're using for CSA. If that is to go through, and again, the General Assembly has to vote on that in 2023. At the locality, you can see an actual increase in local spending on that, on average between $95,000 to $125,000 a year. So, and considering how much of a, shall we say, spirited debate funding the school always tends to be each year during budget season, that's just one more item of that, one more item of intense discussion that may have to come as a result of this. So, again, I just wanted to make the board aware of this when it comes up in 6 to 7 months. However, there's a little bit of good news as what's happened. As always, because with our program, because we're serving more children, our program has to grow. And we've done some growth this year. One major part of that has been using technology, again, to work smarter, not harder. Next slide. So last year, the Board of Supervisors approved funding for my department to start using DocuSign to use for a lot of regular, normal documentation that is used in the CSA, purchase orders, invoices, provider agreements with my vendors. Over the past year, you authorized approximately 1,800, and as of yesterday, we've used approximately 2,600 documents that have through this. On average, a document, one of the documents takes about 15, would have to take about 15 minutes of staffing hours to use, to process, to generate, to process, to find people out in the community, to sign, to mail off to providers and whatnot. Now the whole process takes on average 45 seconds. So you have all saved, I've built this, about 700 staff hours from that. And again, I can definitely figure out what to do with 2.5 months of my time. But because the program is also expanding, the public schools are also going to be adding 2 new case managers to handle their increased caseload. They have been a big force in driving more children and families to use us to help get their children back onto a really good path where they make happy, healthy, and safe choices. So always to see them to be have an increased stake in the success of our program. But remember I said I had that extra time? Well, one issue we've been having statewide is the position that this position of CSA coordinator is one that sees a lot of turnover statewide. There are about 130 of us in the Commonwealth. Each year we see about 15 to 20% of our colleagues leave the position to have new ones come in. So if this keep up, on average, every 5 years, we should hypothetically have a completely brand new set of coordinators. That's a big problem in any industry, having that much turnover. So a colleague of mine and I, my colleague was from the Eastern Shore, took a look at this and said, well, what we can do to fix this? So we said, well, you know, what if we took some of these new coordinators and paired them up with some older veteran coordinators, basically creating a mentoring program for new coordinators. We thought it had legs, pitched it out to some of our other peers back in November, and as of April, we have currently helped about 25 mentors so far, our new coordinators so far, have mentors stay in the job and feel much more comfortable in them. The hope is that in doing so, this is going to reduce our turnover rate from our current 20 to 30%. We're going to get down to like 5% every year, and that's just from, and that we hope that's when people retire. So, again, your support of this program has been making an impact on the state level. So, thank you all very much for that. That being said, did anyone have any questions about the program or anything that's happened in the past year?
Any? The only thing I'll say, I like the end of this one better than the other one, because last time you said I'm going to have to come back and ask for more money. That's the first time you've done that in a couple of years. So I'm glad that you didn't have to. So thank you.
You and me both. Thank you for your time.
Next up, F, Pleasant Grove Park Light Poles Fixtures, donation from UVA, Mr. Spitzer.
You can have me a donation. All right. Good evening. How y'all doing this evening? So I'm here to talk about a possible donation to Savannah County from UVA that I was approached about. I've been working with Musco Lighting because I'm working on getting the soccer fields lit coming up and one of the ball fields lit. I'll explain that here in a minute. So during their conversations, UVA is taking down two light poles and putting a building up in an area, and they have no use for these light poles. So they knew we were doing a project and didn't know if we wanted to take a donation for the light poles. So each light pole is worth about $35,000, so it'd be about a $70,000 donation we would get. But as you'll see here in a minute, it's going to cost some money to continue with the donation. We would have to put in precast pole for the poles in the ground, which are $5,000 a piece. We got to connect the fixtures to the power to get them to running. That's going to depends on what we'd have to do. That'd be between $20,000 and $40,000. So the cost to get the lights up and running would be about $50,000 cost, no more. But if we were to do this without the donation, then go ahead and add, you know, $70,000, so it'd be a $120,000 cost that we would ensue. In my presentation, I previously asked to put them at the rodeo field at Pleasant Grove. Well, met with Musco today. We have a new plan. I like to put them in the soccer parking lot, because we will have an issue if we have lights out there with no issue with no lights in the parking area. So we are going to have an issue with lighting up our parking area at night anyway, moving forward. So this would help alleviate that with this donation. This slide kind of shows you where the poles would be. So that I should have used different colors, and I'm sorry about that. The X is where I was proposing to put the light towers. Actually, they'd be kind of over in that area right there. The soccer field will take 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 light poles to light up. The softball field would take 4. The baseball field would take, I think it's 8, right? 6 or 8. So with funding that we have to do the project, to light all those three fields would be $1.1 million, and we have $685,000 for the project. This is kind of where we are. The baseball field hardly ever gets used, so that is why that won't be lit up at this time. I would like to light up the fields that I can get used the most, and we would have the most use out of them. So that's why this diagram is kind of there, to see what we would be lighting up as we move along. These are what the poles will look like. They're all 12 illuminates. If we move them to the parking lot, we might be able to take a couple illuminates off to decrease how much power is being used, because of the parking lot doesn't need as much. Those were all things we were kind of discussing today. Is there any questions that I can try to answer?
I guess my question would be, is there going to be any, you don't think there'll be enough residual lighting from the soccer fields to cover?
So these will be two different type of lights that will be out there. The lights that we will be getting donated are illuminated lights. The lights we will be getting for the soccer field, the base, and the softball field will be LED lights. LED lights shine straight down, basically, and they have a box around them, so they don't show any illumination outside of like your area that you're actually illuminating, as these lights project high up and across, not down, so they will project lights out. So there will be two different types of lights out there if we do accept this donation. But they are not making these lights anymore. These light poles, they still make the bulbs and stuff to fix them, but they're all going to LEDs.
Yeah, like I said, we know this is a big request, and again, it came up at the last minute. It's not in the budget. It wasn't even contemplated. Again, just Musco.
They just contacted me and asked me if we wanted a donation of 2 light towers, and they knew we were doing a project to try to help the county kind of save a little bit of money in the long run, but it does cost, you know, it's not a free donation. It's not.
Yeah, it's like when you you want to buy something for $100, but it's there's a 50% off sale. But do you need it? Well, you know, do you spend the $50 to do it or not? I mean, and granted, this is way more than $50.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Ultimately, to the plan that we had in place, because we did not, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we did did have plans to light the parking lot, right?
No.
No, there were no plans to light the parking lot.
So this is, no matter how you shake it, this is an addition to the cost of that project.
It is. I mean, again, originally the $685 that the board approved last fiscal year at that point was
to light the three
to light all three fields. Now
five, because it's three
fields. The three soccer and then the two ball fields. Well, now that $685 doesn't light all those fields.
How much is left over from $685 when you don't do the baseball?
Nothing. The $685.
The $685 would put us at $1.1 million almost. To light the baseball field.
So
we're asking $300,000 or more, $350,000 to light
the baseball field. I was just wondering if, because you didn't do the baseball field, there might be $50,000 left over there.
No, I would like the baseball field, but with the funding that was given to me with the request and the price, everything going up, we just didn't have enough money to do all three. So we get the most uses out of our soccer field and our softball field, is why I would choose those areas to light up and not the baseball. The baseball field hardly ever gets played over at all. We would use softball out there. That's why I'm getting ready to buy these pitching mounds to take the mounds out so we can use that field as a softball field for warm-ups or something, you know what I'm saying? It just doesn't get used. I'm a huge baseball person, and it hurts me not to light a baseball field up, but it doesn't get used, and I think it would not benefit the county to light that field up at this time with the amount of kids we have using it.
And you know, the one thing I was talking to Mr. Spitzer, I'm like, well, is there any way that, you know, just when we were talking with the lights, is there any way that these lights would be able to offset, you know, what was being done elsewhere? But, you know, him, you know, kind of talking with the lighting thing, you know, you don't want to really mix these type of other non-LED lights with LED lights, and then, you know, you're kind of in the same field, so...
And if there is a better place that you know of for these lights to go in Savannah County, I'm okay with that too. You know, it's a day-to-day issue for Savannah County, not the Parks and Recreation.
Have there been any safety incidents in the parking lot?
We're not open at dark. We're closed dawn to dusk. So when we get the lights in, and I'm hoping it starts in January, we get the lights in by January, then we will have an issue where we're open at dark. Y'all recently approved in the budget for me two gates to close off towards the house, behind the house and towards the garden. So I'll be able to close off and that off at night to send everybody down towards the soccer fields. But there's no lighting inside actually the main road into the park to get back there. So it will be dark until you get back that way.
Knowing how the traffic flows out of there, would you anticipate that if it was not lit that you would have potential safety incidents?
Well, yeah, because you'd have kids running around everywhere in the dark area with a headlight of a car come in and would say they didn't even turn their headlights on yet when they pull it out and they, you know, clip a kid. So there is going to be some issues. I mean, I also have some money in the CIP to put a fence up. So when we do that, I'm hoping to maybe be able to move parking around a little bit for handicap accessibility closer to the fields and stuff. But there's issues with people driving back there, kids running around.
The only other place I thought about in the county you could do that, and I'm not sure if they've looked into doing it yet or not, is, I know I could call Coach Carter and he could tell me, the football field at middle school, those lights are...
Theirs are not the same type of lights, I don't believe, at the middle school. These lights are like the ones at the high school. These are the high school lights.
I got you.
So they would look different if you... But it is what it is.
Something better than nothing.
Yes, it is.
And right now we got two poles over there that if you go to light them up, I remember when I was a young coach, we would all rock, paper, scissors on who was going to cut the lights on or off.
See if you got shot.
Exactly.
I've been over there. So, like I said, it's a donation to Flubana County, not to Parks and Recreation. Bosco just thought, as we were doing our lighting project, that we could help the county out a little bit as we were doing that project.
Go back to your last picture. Yep. And the only thing I thought about with the parking lot is if you put one over in that corner and tilted it to where we
could have a tree line?
Well, cover the playground as well.
Well, so I'm thinking about that.
Offset
with
light
one light?
The playground.
With one light up top, I was thinking about reaching over
if
to cover.
Put it right over there at the tree line.
You and then I have to have another one on the bottom side of the tree line because of the tree line will block the illuminance.
Come down here at the bottom.
Yeah, so I have to have, we will actually kind of have to have two lights over there to like the whole parking lot.
Add a whole new experience to the handicap line. I'm sorry.
I mean, to me, in the original plan and design, these weren't included. And I don't want to look a gift horse, but this is an additional cost. It's not, there's nothing, it's just less than what it would have cost to, quote unquote, add this in to the overall plan. And now if we're looking for somewhere that we can place it and make use, we're really looking to spend money that we otherwise weren't going to.
Well, my one question to that would be, how long is it going to be before they're going to come back and ask us for parking lot lights?
You're going to need lights at the parking lot sooner or later.
Right. I mean, if it's an identifiable security issue down the road, and it wasn't thought about, well, you know, then just as we saw in the delay, because I think you've been requesting lights for the fields for the last 7 or 8 years, I'm sure when we started 7 years ago, the price was probably $400,000.
That was before I started, yeah.
Every year we wait, the price goes up, and you know, if we're going to put the lights in the next year and a half, and then all of a sudden we're going to have to put in lights for the parking lot area, well, it's going to cost us probably triple of what it would cost us right now. So yeah, it is more than what was budgeted, but if it's ultimately the need, it is less than what we will pay.
And I'll be honest with you, the parking lot issue didn't come up till this morning, and the three of us were out there looking at it, and we're like, you know, what are we going to do with these people parking over there? It really wasn't thought about when we were just trying to light the fields, you know? That's what you did when you do something and you learn, I reckon, right?
Well, I think, the shadows when you're right, in the dark, when you have the shadows that are formed by the headlights and cars moving in and out, and all the kids moving there. That's more challenging for sure.
So yeah, we'll have to light it up, I think, somehow.
And having been hit by a car when I was a young man, it was not.
Now we know what's wrong.
It was a police car too.
But when we talk about, Tony, I hear what you're saying about it will only cost more at another time. There's a lot of things we want to do at Pleasant Grove, so let's just do it all now. And I don't mean it sarcastically, but everything we want to do there in the future will cost more than it will now. And so, and I'm not saying I'm against this, I'm just saying that
I understand the principle.
It's money that, we just another piece of money that we weren't budgeted, that wasn't budgeted in, that we're now discussing. But is there any requirement that they get installed now?
No. Well, I'd have to find somewhere to store them, and then you don't really want to lay them on the ground, per se, for months on an end, you know what I'm saying?
If we picked the place to put them for $10,000, we could stand them up and just not hook the electricity.
But then, I wasn't hooking the electricity up, so I came and did it with the rest of the lighting.
Because, he's not planning on doing this whole lighting project until, fall.
I'm trying to hook, if I was going to use these two light poles, I was going to do all the hookups at one time.
Yep.
So they would be, November to January is when.
Can we look back at the numbers?
Yeah.
That's worst case scenario if we got to put in another panel box.
We will try to hook these up to a panel box we're going to put in for the new lights.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Try to be able to use the same one.
It could reduce the price, yes.
That's what I read down here, $10,000.
And with us, I think moving the lights from where I thought being the carnival field down to the parking lot area, that will save, I think, on a little bit of conduit and stuff and electric, how far we have to run it.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, we're almost at the end of the year, and we have $93,000 minus $3,000, so we have $90,000 left in the board contingency. Probably not likely to spend that. So
you know, you could say it's not budgeted, but we budget the board contingency for opportunities and or, you know, things that don't go the way we plan. So, I mean, again, if I'm looking down the road and saying I'm going to spend $50,000 more just by default and having to purchase these because the other costs are fixed, then this is a $50,000 savings to the county.
What I would maybe say is if the board says we want to move forward with this, what I would probably recommend is if you wanted to use BOS contingency, take the $50,000 out of BOS contingency and put it into the CIP project. That's kind of outstanding for the whole lighting thing. So the money's just kind of there. So once, for one, the $10,000 would be there to do the install of the precast to get them up. And then once the whole project kind of gets going for the installation, then the funds are there to kind of add to the remaining piece of it.
And if the installation turns out to be $648,000 because of the number of lights that we select, then, you know, okay, we're back to where we were.
Two quick questions. Do we know how old the poles are and how long they're supposed to last?
They're relatively new. I do not know the exact age. And 20 years?
I was going to say 30.
20-year pole, I think, is what the school has. 20, 25 years is their life expectancy. And I think these are within the last 5 to 10 years they were put up. I would say within the last 5, I think, is what... I can't guarantee that, though.
That part of it cost us nothing. And if something happens to them 10 years, 15 years from now, and we want to replace them, we already got the bases there. We just replace them.
You'll have to get LED lights moving.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm saying.
But yeah, the electrical work.
There. Correct. The electrical work will already be done. Joe?
I was thinking I would turn this deal down after what you said. We do have some money that we could move on. Someone's giving you.
Ms. Seeger? I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
Did you say
the
return?
No, I wouldn't. I would return it down.
Ms. Seeger?
I guess we're going to need lighting down in that area sometime. And
I think that's going to end up... And heaven forbid, we don't want it to be after something happens, right. And then we become reactive.
Yeah.
And say, oh, darn, we wish we should have put some lights on.
Would it be possible to get the poles and install them and then have them on?
Correct. That's what we're just talking about. I mean, we'll have to check on that about do they have to have the wiring already done when they put them on the dump?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Fairchild?
Yeah, I see both sides, but
all right, let's move forward.
So do you want me to put, is there any reason you want it on action, or would you put it under consent?
Put it under consent.
And then I'll use BOS
contingency. Because we've all 5 said yes to it.
Okay. So I'll let them know.
Yep.
All right, thank you.
Can I tell them thank you very much?
We will. Thank you.
Thanks for thanking of us.
That's good. I appreciate it. You know, I called them. Thank you,
sir. I'm sure you did. Yes, sir. All right, G, noise control ordinance amendment discussion. Major Wells.
Mr. Chairman, let me give you the legal background of this. I've talked to Mr.
Yeah, I was trying to read that.
You saw in the staff report, this regime was adopted in 2001. And in 2009, the Supreme Court played a little trick on from the localities and basically, if it had been reformed, they would probably have been invalidated our scheme. Objection the Supreme Court had was to the Virginia Beach ordinance was that it was too subjective. So we answered that by saying, well, we'll get a true scientific measure of this, and the scientific measure would be the sound meters. I'm confident that the sound meters would satisfy the holding of the Tanner case. The problem is, and Peter Wilson saying all about this, they don't work very well. It's not that we don't have the right meters or anything. It's that the conditions have to be set up to use them in such a way that it's not practical to use them for enforcement. The other thing is, as I tell you, the magistrates have gotten kind of picky about it. And they look at this ordinance and say, why didn't you bring the meters in? What we're asking for is for your MDOTs, go ahead with drafting some regulations. I haven't drafted this ordinance yet, but my contemplation is that we're going to use Bladen County as the primary example. And apparently, it's been enforced for some time. It's never been, I don't think it's ever been successful in towns. So that recommends it. But we didn't want to do that. Didn't want to spend any time on it until you all get us in.
What you said. No, essentially, as it is on the books, it's unenforceable. If you read the entirety of the code, it talks about the sound meter set up in accordance with the National Equipment Association's thing. It says you have to be 4 foot from the ground, approximately X amount of yards from the house. You have to have 5 minutes of no sound, a 5 minute continuous sound reading. And obviously, if someone's having a late night party, you can't really get over there, pull out a tripod or a measuring device, and okay, turn it down, let me get a pre-sound reading. Okay, now turn it back where you had it for 5 minutes. And not to mention, the citizen has a complaint, and we get there and it's already off, they can't come get a warrant because the magistrate's told them multiple times is where the sound readings. The code, it's a very lengthy code that's just not practical for. So we're trying to find some more options. I've been bugging them for a couple of years now to try to find something so that we can at least take some action. And people know it's unenforceable, so they basically tell us to,
have fun.
Yeah.
So what is in Loudon's case, what is the gist of it that would make it, what is the big change?
It takes away some of the subjective criteria.
Okay. It takes away no sound.
The words in the Virginia Beach case were things like unreasonable and annoying.
Yeah, it was very vague. Basically, it is to disturb the quietude of the neighborhood.
Which I think is perfectly reasonable.
The Loudon basically says if it can be heard in the household after 11 o'clock, that's probably not right.
Does that be a dog barking too?
There's an enumerated list of things on that, like gunfire, some of the things are explicitly excluded, but I believe it does talk about dogs. I sent them a couple of drafts. We're just trying to find something. We get a lot of complaints. People complain, sorry, there's nothing I can do. They get mad. And I understand that you're trying to sleep and there's somebody out there revving their engine, working the car, or having a loud party.
Shooting guns at 2 a.m.
Correct.
Well, the New Year's Eve does not count.
Right, there's a couple of different versions I found where you can put into it, I have to give them a warning first, or it's going to be a civil penalty, and it doesn't go to criminal until after like your third offensive year. So we're not trying to be draconian by any means. We just want to keep the peace, basically.
Did this come up in part because of that Scottsville?
One of many reasons, yes.
But just so others know, if you didn't know, there's a neighborhood in the Cunningham District where there's a neighbor who's got everybody else's attention, including beyond midnight in different ways. And Eric was, Sheriff Hass was good enough to come over and have a community meeting, and the gist of it was that they really didn't have a way to try to, they had very little way to try to enforce or to stop this from happening. And so it sounds like to me this is an effort to...
It is. That's what sparked my latest series of emails. One draft I said did explicitly talk about, for lack of a better term, recreational gunfire between these hours. It's different if it's, for hunting coyotes at night or for self-defense purposes, but no more. Hey, it's midnight.
I won't even say shoot and skeet, but somebody goes out there with a 30-round clip, just unloads it for
right,
no
at 2 in the morning.
Which is basically
on a habitual basis. That's what we're looking for, is habitual.
Habitual.
Or people who, when we knock on the door and we go, can you please just quiet down and say, nope, and just keep going. We're just trying to fix a problem in the best way we can to keep the citizens at least kind of happy.
So the question is if we want some sort of draft. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, what we propose is going through and bringing a draft to the board, and just, we didn't want to get any staff time going on at the board. It's like, well, no, we're happy with where things are right now.
I want to use the existing ordinance to the extent that we can, but we're going to do some serious cutting on it. But exactly where we change it, or how we change it, is something that Major Bell and I are going to have to talk about.
Yeah. And we have to have a public hearing,
huh? Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is an ordinance change, yeah.
Oh, it's odd, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to say it's a good thing that agriculture is not
you've ever heard a cow jump on your calf?
That's right.
It's one loud voice.
We were aware of that when we wrote the ordinance.
The one thing that gets me is with the dogs barking. I mean, I know it's if you're close, but like in my house, I'll have coyotes come in my yard.
Right.
When the dogs start raising cane, I know when there's a coyote in.
Yeah, well, and the intent again is to craft it away for the no individual nuisances, not the, let's say, nuances of living in a rural environment, if you will.
The chances are, if he sends an officer out there, the officer says, would you tone it down? And the person says, heck
up,
you,
up yours.
You're not going to do it. And the officer has the authority to issue a summons as opposed to going to the magistrate and getting a warrant. That's going to be a big deterrent.
And detention.
Because people don't want to show up. Cool.
Yeah, and then it's their case.
I'm going to have a bunch of questions once we get it, so I'm probably better.
Just wait.
Well, if you have questions, I appreciate that.
Well,
no, I don't mean that.
No. Because I really do.
Like you said, it's with a public hearing, people will hear about it.
The law ordinance explicitly talks about agricultural, farm implements, generators, and again, you're trying to set some quiet hours, the basic, right, that are civil.
Great.
So I get head nods to move forward?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you. All right, next up is the consent agenda. H, minutes of May 18th, 2022. Personnel policy update, Ms. Snow. J, FY22 Circuit Court Preservation Fund Supplemental Appropriations, Ms. Melton. K, FY22 ARPA Municipal Utility Funds Supplemental Appropriation, Ms. Melton. L, FY22 CARES Act Supplemental Appropriation, Ms. Melton. M, FY22 51 Kenstore Way Insurance Claim, Ms. Melton. And FY22 Department of Social Services Share of the Cost Allocation Funds, Ms. Melton. Hang on. Do I have anything that we want to pull? Do y'all have anything you want to pull? Do I have a motion?
So made.
Second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Is there any unfinished business?
I just want to say thanks to Eric for on Friday sending me an email about my questions about personal property. And to me, it's worth the time to go through with taxpayers that are still asking questions and confused. And so on his time off Friday, sent that in the evening. And, but I was also relieved to know that you didn't know either, really, meaning what I kept trying to think of, how would you set where that number is and how would you...
I mean, that's the thing. It would almost be impossible, I mean, to make every citizen whole. I mean, to make every citizen whole, kind of what I said is, you'd have to find out what was the largest increase in vehicle value and make that as the baseline, and then make the equalized rate based on that. And then everyone below that, I mean, they're going to be flat or they're going to have a decrease. So, you know, again, if the commissioner were to say, well, overall in the county, were 16.5% increase. Well, that's just kind of taking everything overall. You know, within there, there's going to be someone that's 30% and someone that's 10%. So there's just not an. And in the same way, when we do equalization too, everyone's property. When we do the equalization, everyone's properties appreciate, mostly appreciate.
Each area is different.
Yeah.
The two times ago, it was Kent Store that went up really high, and this past time it was a lake.
Yeah, like I showed you for my two vehicles. I mean, they were, you know, one year they were one vehicle decreased, one increased a little bit, and then the next year they both increased at different levels. So again, you know, I certainly feel for those residents that maybe got a little surprise in their personal property tax rate, but from the county standpoint, I think the board did a lot to try and take that into account, that they were going to see something, and so, you know, it would have been great if we could have made it all whole, but I think that would have been a pretty expensive task to do that.
How many concerns do you think we had?
I was sat in the commission.
You might have asked Mel to know that.
Personal property taxes today, and ended up sitting in there for about 45 minutes.
Did you bring on the phone or people coming?
Ma'am, sitting there, they had at least 10 phone calls while I was sitting there. At least 10, and it's quiet. It hadn't quieted down totally, but it's less now than it was. When it first came out, it was as soon as they hung the phone up, they were on the phone
and
with somebody
else.
And
it's still not really understood.
Well, the one thing I can tell you is this. What was it? We went down 65 cents out of 435. So what is that, about 17%?
It was a 15% decrease.
15% decrease that we had. That, and, you know, we, like you said, you made a great point with the different vehicles. You can't make it perfect. I believe Mel came in here and said like 310 would have been quote unquote an equalized rate, but
again, that's not everyone's going to see it. Right.
Yeah, and you know, just
well, I guess we need to make do it. If this happens again, maybe you just need to do a better job of informing the citizens or something.
There's no way you're going to satisfy somebody.
I know that.
In that situation,
at least let's try.
Certainly,
absolutely.
But the challenge was that it's very hard for a citizen to understand that a car that he purchased 2 years ago is now more expensive than when he bought it. I mean, that's, well, we don't control that. You know?
I'll tell you this much. Y'all know I had the wreck. My vehicle was 4 years old. They eventually came back and said it's worth exactly what you paid for it. After I've driven it for 4 years plus.
It's kind of, I agree with Moselle. That I don't think this is going to come about next year. I think it's going to be some different time.
Well, we may have to raise it next year.
We don't know. But I think if it was to happen again, I do feel we should communicate. And then I'd just say that it made me feel better, because if a guy that is educated and has worked in government finance didn't have a better solution than that, I wasn't going to either.
I can only tell you this much. I would hate to have been sitting in the other commissioner's offices.
It never went
down.
No, I don't.
Because
there's I think there's probably a good amount of them too.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and like I said, I think the board did a good thing by both decreasing the personal property and the real estate. Yeah. So,
We did not decrease real estate. We were 1/10 of a penny from the equalized rate.
Well, it's not a reassessment year.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, we went down, what was it, 1.4 cent?
Yep.
All right. Is there any new business? Hearing none, I will now open the second round of public comment. Anyone wishing to speak, please state your name and address. Keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak at this time? Anybody online?
No.
All righty, I will now close the second round of public comment. Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, I move the Flanagan County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A1, Section 2.2-3711A3, Section 2.2-3711A5, Section 2.2-3711A7, Section 2.2-3711A19 of the Code of Virginia 1915 for the purposes of discussing personnel, county administrator's performance evaluation, employee performance matters, real estate, disposition of county-owned property, prospective industry, prospective business, litigation, actual litigation in connection with Quigley Properties LLC, public safety EMS service.
Second.
We have a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. We'll see y'all in the morning.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned to the Flagler County Board of Supervisors to meet again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge one only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
I have a second. The motion is made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Seeger. Ms. Seeger? Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. Fairchild?
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien? The chair votes aye. We're now in a closed session. Do I have a motion to extend until 10 o'clock?
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair opposed, chair votes aye. We are adjourned.